Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Let's continue our Bostonomics series on the future of work. And today we're going to take a look at the gig economy. I mean, there's TaskRabbit, Uber, Lyft, and the like. But the idea of gig workers is becoming more prevalent in even other areas of work. You know, for lots of folks, that provides flexibility and autonomy. But it also provides some challenges. Instability, or perhaps a lack of benefits. Now, we're going to talk to a labor expert about this in just a couple of minutes. But first, WBOR Bostonomics reporter Zanindra Enwemeka has been reporting on the gig economy, and she joins us now. Hi there, Zanindra.
Hey, Meghna.
Okay, so this is a growing area of work, but how big is it?
Absolutely. So a McKinsey study found that there are about 54 to 68 million independent workers in the U.S. And as you mentioned, it's growing. So there is a major study that was co-authored by Harvard economist Larry Katz that found that the gig economy accounted for 90% of net employment growth between 2005 and 2015. And that's all kinds of gig work. So the big takeaway here is it is rapidly growing.
Okay. Wow. And so, I mean, the tech platforms that I talked about a second ago are one aspect, but companies or established companies are also offering fewer full-time jobs. Is that what's going on?
Yeah, absolutely. So the gig economy isn't just your Uber, Lyft, and all of those sort of tech-driven platforms. Experts I spoke with say that really only accounts for less than 1% of the gig economy. Gig work is mostly for your freelancers, part-timers, contract workers. And the big piece of this is that employers are offering fewer full-time jobs. Here's Harvard economist Larry Katz.
What we've seen a very big trend towards is a growth of contracting out, the use of freelancers, the use of independent contractors. So even though people may be doing the same sort of job in the same location, they're no longer employees of that organization.
I'm sorry. I'm still taken by those tech-driven gig workers are only 1% of gig work. So we're talking 99% in these other inside of a company, but not getting the same benefits, for example.
Absolutely, I mean, I know we hear so much about Uber, Lyft, and more of the technology side of this, but a lot of it is those contract workers who are, in many cases, doing the same amount of work, but not necessarily getting the benefits of a full-time employee.
Or even a stable salary, right? Because by definition, they're freelancers.
Oh, well, absolutely, yeah. And I mean, this is a big challenge for gig workers. They don't get the same benefits as full-time workers. So everything from healthcare, retirement, even tax benefits. And I mean, there are some efforts underway to address this that are pretty nascent, I would say. There's legislation in Congress. There's a few states that are looking at bills to create some sort of a system that would give benefits to contract or contingent workers.
Okay. So is this the future, though? If that 90% of jobs growing in the gig economy, should young people basically expect to never have full-time jobs?
Well, that's what some people believe. A lot of the people that I spoke with don't necessarily think that jobs are going away per se, but they believe that work will change and it will be organized differently. So here, the big takeaway is people will need to be able to retrain, to take on new skills, and learn to work in non-traditional ways. Again, here's Harvard economist Larry Katz.
I view us partially as losing the race between, you know, education and technology that we kept up in the past by not providing the opportunities for many workers to get the training to take advantage of the changes in the economy.
Interesting. So it makes me wonder if workers in the future are going to need a brand new skill set in order to really operate in an economy where they may be changing jobs all the time.
Yeah, I mean, it's about making sure you have the right skills, and that's technical skills, but also soft skills, professional skills. And I think more broadly, it's this ability to keep learning, to keep developing skills so that you can adapt and you can work in non-traditional ways as the labor market continues to change. Here's how Diane Mulcahy puts it. She's an adjunct lecturer at Babson College and has written a book about the gig economy.
Imagine a scenario in which you knew that in 6 months you were going to be laid off from your job. What would you do? Who would you connect with? What conferences would you go to? What certifications might you get? What would you do personally? What would you do financially? Make a list of all those things and start doing it. Be ready to leave your job, because there is no such thing as job security anymore.
I feel like an old person because that's kind of scary to me.
Yeah, it's kind of scary. It's almost like this idea of an economic go bag.
Yeah, wow. Finding the next job is a job in and of itself, honestly.
Absolutely.
That's WBUR Bostonomics reporter Zanindra Enwemeka. Zanindra, thanks so much.
Sure thing, Meghna.
And on All Things Considered in the next hour, you can hear Zanindra's profile of Year Up, a program that helps young people get training for their future professional careers. But before we go, I want to talk to an expert on labor and the economy. He's David Weil, Dean of the Heller School for Social Policy and Management at Brandeis and former head of the Wage and Hour Division at the Department of Labor under President Obama. David Weil, welcome to Radio Boston and thank you for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
So on the one hand, I have to say that the booming growth of the gig economy does allow workers flexibility, autonomy, and in an ideal setting, sort of that frictionless economic setting where you can move from job to job and, I don't know, maybe that's the source of more innovation and a healthier economy, right? But on the other hand, do we have a social safety net set up such that those people can retire,
right.
Such that they can have health care, such that they can have so many of the basic needs that have been put on employers in the past 50 years?
I think that's really the central question raised by the kinds of changes we've just heard about. We have so many of our social policies are built around an employment model where we believe there was sort of a simple one employer and an employee, and they basically met, and we had certain protections built in around the employment relationship. The changes that have happened to employment have in many ways been under the hood, and people haven't really realized them. You go into a hotel, and you think you're at the brand you walked in on. It's a Hilton. It's a Marriott. In fact, you have a group of subcontractors and staffing mm-hmm. agencies who are actually the employers of record. When we broke apart employment in that way, it's what I've called fissuring the economy, a lot of the protections we used to have for those workers go away. If you are being treated, for instance, as an independent contractor, you no longer have unemployment insurance or worker compensation protection.
Right.
It's no longer clear who's responsible for your health and safety on the workplace. Even doing something that my former agency did, which is ensuring that people get just paid out wages for the work they do, can be undermined when you have this complexity of people.
Right, because so much of employment law is built on the traditional expectations of an employer-employee relationship,
right?
And full-time job, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, but now, as Zanindra was telling us, we have a situation in which even sort of standard employers, because they're hiring contract workers, that contract worker may be under the same roof, you know, working in the same company for a long period of time. But because they're going from contract to contract, they're not getting the same benefits or protections. So are there changes that we can make to labor laws to cover folks like that?
I think there are, and they are to recognize the fact that if a person is really operating under the guidance and restriction of a certain employer, you know, go back to my hotel example, although you can find this in distribution centers of the Amazons and the Walmarts of the world or in many other contexts, if we hold other parties to be still responsible for at least some part of what goes on within their walls, that becomes an important incentive for them to again, take more responsibility for what has been increasingly shifted onto subcontractors or even more challenging individual workers
yeah.
who face all the risk.
Now, I should ask just for clarification. Does the law or policy see gig workers and temporary workers and freelance or contract workers as different groups of employees?
It can, and it all goes to how they're being classified. So the law has, and different laws define this somewhat differently, but they all say this is what an employment relationship looks like, and it's about control and really responsibility for all the things that happen at the workplace. We call that an employment relationship, whether it's in a staffing agency, a subcontracting relationship, or the sort of traditional model we have in our mind, as opposed to the person who truly is a real freelancer, who really is, in a sense, an independent business person who is responsible for their own profit and loss in their own business. The problem is increasingly with this fissuring of the economy, that gray line has been really bridged. And a lot of people are being called independent contractors, where in reality, if you look at what our laws say, they're still employees.
Well, I mean, Uber's the big example.
Absolutely.
Here, right? I mean, when you were in the Obama administration, I mean, I believe you spoke about this. You suggested that a lot of gig economy companies are calling their workers independent contractors when they're you say that that's a misclassification.
That's exactly right. In fact, we issued guidance in 2015 to really clarify who is a legitimate independent contractor and who is an employee. And we made the point in that guidance that most people in work relationships are, in fact, employees. I mean, that's just factually an accurate statement. Some of the greatest reaction to that came from the digital platform world, who said, wait a minute, we built our whole models around considering everyone as independent contractors. And so while you have the TaskRabbits of the world, who truly are bridges, they're digital bridges between independent contractors operating their services and their activities with potential consumers, you have companies like Uber who are dictating all of the terms and conditions of what happens in the car, where they go,
the
rates.
It's the control of the work itself.
It's the control and really the fact that everything that's – Uber is a branded company. That's why they're worth billions and billions of dollars. So it's somewhat of a fiction just because they happen to summon their workforce via a digital platform. That in and of itself does not make them an independent contractor platform.
I should note, though, that the Trump administration moved away from the guidance you issued under the Obama administration.
That's absolutely right. They pulled the guidance down.
Okay. So these are giant policy questions that we have, though, because the very nature of work, as we've been hearing all week from the Bostonomics series, is changing. And if we are basically aggressively moving into a world where no one can presume to have the standard employer-employee relationship, we've talked about the challenges there,
right,
and perhaps there's policy solutions around there. But I just want to ask you if you do see an upside to this, though, because I think a lot of people feel like the flexibility and the autonomy does provide them with opportunities that they can't have in a traditional employer-employee relationship.
Right. And it is true that in many of these arrangements, there is greater flexibility. It does provide people a better way to balance family, work-life issues or other non-work activities. One of the points, though, I made when I was in government, and I continue to really stress, is there's nothing inherent about employment that doesn't mean you can build in flexibility. There are many employers who actually are very fine employers, very responsible employers, and figure out ways to make the workplace a flexible place that both reflects what workers need and what an employer needs.
Right. Oh, that's a very good point. I always feel like we end on a point where we should do a whole nother hour about what the person just said. But David Weil, Dean of the Heller School for Social Policy and Management at Brandeis University, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
And again, listeners, a reminder, WBR's Bostonomics series on the future of work continues on All Things Considered next hour, so stay tuned for that and tomorrow as well. That's it for today. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. We'll be right back.